You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
We're inside a music venue called a lighthouse in one of China's biggest cities. The room is packed with music lovers and there's a band on stage. And yes, they are covering a classic song by the legendary American punk band, The Stooges. This is Wuhan, 2021. It's a very different city to what it was 1 year ago. It's a very different world than what it was 1 year ago. In late January 2020, the world watched as the city of Wuhan and its 11 million people went into lockdown as authorities fought to control the spread of coronavirus. Today, the people of Wuhan move about freely. But elsewhere in China, the situation is very different. There's a new virus outbreak in northern China, starting from the Hebei province neighboring Beijing. And now, multiple cities across the northern China region are under lockdown, affecting more than 20 million people. This week, China reported more than 100 new cases of COVID-19 for the sixth consecutive day. In a nation of 1.5 billion people, that doesn't sound like much. But this is some 3 months after the international medical journal The Lancet hailed China's success in controlling the spread of the virus. And keep in mind, this comes just before the yearly event we know in China as Chunyun, otherwise known as the biggest annual migration of human beings in the world during the Chinese Spring Festival, where an estimated 7 million people pack their bags and head home to see their families for Chinese New Year. Beijing has once again brought in strict rules demanding all new arrivals be quarantined for a total of 28 days, 14 days in designated hotel and 14 days at home.
Meanwhile, the United Kingdom is going into its third national lockdown as its hospitals reach breaking point. Germany, Poland, and the Netherlands have just finished weeks of lockdowns. And this week, the global death toll passed 2 million. Almost 12,000 people per day are now dying of COVID-19. But as ever, there is always hope. As we reported last week, tens of millions of people are being vaccinated across the world as the biggest inoculation program in history gets underway. There are now 10 different vaccines in use. There are more than 60 other vaccines in clinical trials, and 20 of those are in the final stages of testing. And for all of us here in Hong Kong, it's 1 year since the first reported case of coronavirus. And almost exactly 1 year since we made our very first podcast about the coronavirus. Here's what that sounded like.
I'm talking to you in an office that's normally buzzing with reporters from 10 different desks here at the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong. Over the Lunar New Year holiday, it normally gets fairly quiet in here, but over the past week, one desk in particular has been powering through the public holiday. I'm talking about my colleagues on the China desk here at the SCMP, who have been covering what is one of the biggest health crises in China since the outbreak of SARS in 2003. And while many of them live here in Hong Kong, there are many others in our team who are either based in mainland China or who have spent the Lunar New Year holiday visiting friends and family there. In this podcast, we're going to give you...
Welcome to Inside China. My name is Mimi Lau.
And my name is Kinling Lo. In this episode, we are going to hear from one of our colleagues who was among the few journalists who visited Wuhan in the first weeks of January last year. He returned to the city just a couple of weeks ago. And we are going to hear more about the investigation team from the World Health Organization, which has landed in China to begin its investigation into the origins of the coronavirus.
And we'll catch up with that man whose voice you just heard. He's been following the economic impacts of the virus on China. Before we go on, as always, A reminder that the latest news, the latest updates on everything about a pandemic can be found 24 hours a day at the South China Morning Post website, scmp.com.
Let's start with where we left off last week. Simone McCarthy, last time you spoke to us, you've just filed a story about two members of the WHO investigation team heading to China being rejected because they tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies. What happened since then?
That was actually a pretty hectic day. Basically, there had been a team of 15 scientists that were supposed to be flying on that day from Singapore into China's Wuhan, which is where the first known cluster of cases was identified in late 2019. And two of the scientists, so they'd all gone through many tests before they traveled and after they landed in Singapore, and then in order to be cleared to fly over to China. And all of the scientists tested negative for the usual kind of test that we use, the PCR nucleic acid test, to see if you have COVID-19. But two of them tested positive for a kind of antibody that China requires a negative test for. And so basically, the reason for that is that there's some indication that this antibody may show a recent or even an active infection. So they were blocked and they were left behind in Singapore while the rest of the team headed on to Wuhan. And since that time, China has cleared one of those experts to go ahead and join the rest of the team. And those guys are now in a two-week quarantine in a hotel in Wuhan. And, you know, some of them have been like posting on Twitter little pictures of the view from their room or what their breakfasts are and everything. But they're already in video meetings with the Chinese scientists. And then after the two-week quarantine, they'll get out and presumably do some site visits and start doing those meetings face-to-face with the Chinese scientists that they're working with.
Do we know any further details of their tour in China? Like, where will they be heading and what result will they be producing afterwards?
Presumably, they'll be staying in Wuhan. They have a sort of what's called a terms of reference document, which basically lays out everything that they're supposed to be working on. And so that's really focused on Wuhan. I mean, the point of this mission, obviously, is to understand the origins of this virus. Scientists are pretty sure that, like the majority of pathogens that have emerged in recent decades, that this one comes from an animal. The evidence that we have indicates that it could be a bat. Maybe that virus from a bat passed into another animal, which then gave it to humans. So the heart of what they're trying to do is figure out, you know, what exactly happened? Is that what happened? Where did it happen? But the point of what they're doing right now is really to rewind the clock. And this major data point that they have is that they know that there was this cluster of cases in Wuhan. And so that's where they're supposed to be focusing right now, is understanding those early patients in Wuhan, getting a sense of what kind of research was done at the market where the first cases, where many of the first cases were linked to.
Before I ask Simone about patient zero, let's just hear from somebody we spoke with last year in our episode. This is Dr. Sarah Bawain. She ran the infection control program in a hospital in Beijing during the SARS outbreak, and she has been a practicing doctor here in Hong Kong for the past 15 years.
Well, so this disease is very cluster-based. It happens in these kind of explosive clusters. And so each one of those has a patient zero or an index case. And it also gives you a lot of information about how the disease spreads when you can figure that out. So in South Korea, not their very first cases, but the big cluster sort of explosion of cases they've had is traced back to a particular patient, and they do know who that patient was. She was attending a funeral for a religious sect and probably had symptoms, I think she did, and that started the outbreak. In Italy, we don't know. We don't know who the first patient in that cluster was, and so that gives us more difficulty understanding what happened there. Similarly, in Iran, no one has any idea what's going on in Iran. Right? So it would be very helpful to know. It gives us idea also of what the risk factors are for getting infected or having large outbreaks.
So Simone, for the WHO team, how important is finding China's patient zero?
That's an interesting question. It probably depends on who you ask. The term patient zero is a bit of a controversial one in any case. I think some scientists would argue that there may not be a patient zero, or certainly that patient zero may never be identified. One of the reasons I say that is just because there are certain kinds of circumstances where a disease that comes from animals might spill into people multiple times before it actually reaches a point where it can spread explosively among a lot of people, or somebody who is infected actually goes into a city or gets on an airplane and then it kind of, boom, goes global. So one of the things that they might be looking for in such an investigation would be actually communities where they can notice some evidence where maybe a lot of people are engaging in sort of a high-risk activity that's bringing them in contact with a kind of animal that may also have traces of the virus. And so maybe it's more about identifying, they call it like an interface, this animal-human interface where there is some risk, as opposed to necessarily saying, oh, it was this person, this is our patient zero. But I should say that's definitely not to say that it's not important to understand those earliest cases. And that's a huge part of what this mission is doing right now. They're going to be combing through hospital records, for example, looking for lung scans that might show signs of something like COVID-19, but the doctors who didn't know that COVID-19 existed would have missed it. A big part of that is also if you have any samples from that time period, going back and testing those. So the idea is that the Chinese scientists would have already been doing this work, and then the WHO team is also coming in and looking at what they've been doing. And really, it is about rewinding that clock, trying to find out not just about the earliest patients and what some of their behaviors were, but are there any patients that are even before the ones that we know, and how do you find those?
So we've been seeing reports for quite a while that there's evidence that the virus was already present in other places before it was identified in Wuhan, for example, in Italy. Is that something that WHO agrees?
I wouldn't say agrees, but the WHO has certainly said that they're looking at all of the evidence. So when a group of researchers comes forward, like we saw with the, there was a serological study where they went back and looked at blood samples from people who were in a cancer screening program in the fall of 2019 in Italy. And there was some indication that there may have been COVID-19 infections among that group. And so the WHO has contacted those researchers and they're working with them to verify the studies. So the WHO has really stressed that they have to start this investigation at that point of the first known cluster. And at this point, based on what we know, that is in Wuhan. The evidence, I mean, there's different kinds of evidence as well that get drawn into this. A serological study is something that it doesn't say, oh, we found this exact virus in your blood and we've isolated it and we can run more experiments on it. It's that we see that you have antibodies to a virus that is either this one or perhaps a similar one. So, I mean, different scientists that I've talked to, they typically caveat that kind of information, but they also say that countries should be doing, countries should be going back and understanding when the disease was first within their borders. Given that the world is so interconnected right now, certainly possible that the disease could have been in China and then spread into Italy as well. So I think part of the mission is trying to look at causation and origin. And really, the other part of that is understanding the animal side of it. Right now, what we know is that that this region of southern China and Southeast Asia is a hotspot for a kind of bat that has carried some pretty close relatives to this SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. So I think it's important to just keep an open mind is what the WHO says, and they've certainly said that the mission may go into other countries. They just need to follow the evidence, and the scientists I speak with generally agree with that too. But I think it's the most important thing is, well, A, it's not about blaming anyone. It's about figuring out where this came from so we can stop something similar from happening again. And, getting to the bottom of this by following the data.
So, Simone, how successful do you think the WHO investigation will be about the origins of the coronavirus?
Well, the WHO itself has said that hunting for the origins of a virus could take years. We've definitely seen that in the past with different zoonotic viruses that have emerged. I think, you know, one of the things that everybody's really paying attention to right now is how much access to data do these scientists get in China. There hasn't been a lot of information released into the public domain about the research that Chinese scientists have already done into the origins of the virus. For example, have they also run those kinds of serological tests that we've seen coming out of Italy during that kind of time frame using those, you know, stored samples? What kinds of animal testing have they done to understand if animals also have traces in their blood? So Chinese scientists have certainly said they've been doing that work. And so we imagine that that's what they're going over with the WHO team. But having transparency in the mission is something that, you know, experts around the world are calling for. So that's one thing. But I think just the nature of the science in and of itself is something that, I mean, in a way, this is like looking for a needle in a haystack. They could get lucky and find some interesting clues. Maybe they see that there's a certain species that was being sold in that market that's raises a red flag, and they follow it back and they find a community where it does look like there was some kind of spillover. Maybe it's something not that straightforward at all. And so time will really tell, and I don't think anyone can put a specific timeline on this. We do know that this international team is supposed to stay in Wuhan for about a month. But whether at the end of that month they'll say, aha, we found the smoking gun, I'd say that's probably pretty unlikely. It's more about laying the groundwork for what happens next.
So, Simone, apart from this narrative about coronavirus being originated in Italy, there was also this narrative floating around, especially last week. The U.S. government said it has evidence the coronavirus came from a laboratory in Wuhan. What was the latest about this?
Yeah, you know, I was actually a little bit surprised to see that State Department memo pop up. I think it was on Friday, because this was a theory that the U.S. government under the Trump administration was talking up a lot over the spring, and saying, you know, we have evidence of this, and then no evidence ever emerged, and sort of fizzled out. And then all of a sudden, just less than a week before a change of administration, with now President Biden taking over, this memo pops up. And so, yeah, they said that they have evidence that there were sick researchers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology in the fall of 2019, and they had symptoms that could be considered consistent with COVID. But again, they don't produce any actual evidence of it. So they make this statement, but they don't present any evidence of it. The WHO scientist who's leading the mission to China actually just addressed this question in a recent statement. And he said, basically, you know, we should look at all theories. But then he laid out why scientists don't think that this is something that's all that likely. I think there's already been a lot of really solid genetic analysis of the virus, which indicates that it was not created in a lab. As for whether or not there could have been a laboratory accident, as Peter Benenbarak, who's the WHO scientist that I just alluded to, you know, he says those kinds of accidents do happen, but you know, I think the other side of that is that nature is a huge laboratory for producing these viruses. And so that's the way that a lot of scientists look at this, as it's much more likely that this would have come from nature than from some kind of freak accident.
If you are one of the millions of people around the world who watched the video stories on the South China Morning Post website, you will probably have seen what this person has seen. But you probably haven't heard his voice.
I'm Thomas Yao. I am a video journalist based in Shanghai with the South China Morning Post.
Thomas has shot and produced all sorts of stories across mainland China and here in Hong Kong. But it was just after New Year's Day 2020 that he remembers chatting with one of his workmates about where his next assignment might be.
I was, before I got called into Wuhan a few days before that, I was talking to my colleagues. I said that, you know, so I think it's only a matter of time that they send me over there. And then I think it is the first week of January, I got a phone call from my boss saying that, you know, something's going on in Wuhan. I think a dozen of people were getting sick. They don't know what it is, but, you know, you should go take a look. But it's probably nothing serious.
Probably nothing serious. Thomas packs his bag, books a two-hour flight from Shanghai to Wuhan. The plane lands, and this is what he remembers about getting off the plane.
It's really is nothing. I mean, I get off the plane, I pass through the customs, I get my bag, I take a cab to the hotel. Pretty much that's it. No one's wearing a mask. There's no one taking a temperature. There's no rubbing alcohol everywhere. Just nothing. There's nothing.
Ah, the good old days. No mask, no temperature checks, no hand sanitizer. Now there's a very good chance you first learn about the city of Wuhan as it was locked down in late January last year. But Thomas is there 3 weeks before this happens.
I think I was there before like the COVID panic kicks in. So everything is still pretty normal. People are still walking down the streets. They were preparing for Chinese New Year. It was just very relaxed. Everything is so normal. But a year later, I go back and don't know. You keep thinking about what the city had been through, like 2 weeks after I left, and then what I have been through and what my family have been through and what the world has been through during the past 12 months. And it's just very surreal to me.
Thomas was part of our team of reporters who were sent into the pandemic epic center Wuhan to find out what was going on the front line. Google the words SCMP video and returning to Wuhan, and you can see some of what Thomas filmed back in 2020. He's walking along the street, asking people, are you worried about this new virus? And you watch as an old man turns to the camera and replies he's not worried at all. Because it wasn't like SARS, but...
It's just crazy to look back. I was like outside a building, you know, the infectious disease building. Even people entering the hospital, I think only half of them were wearing masks. And whether you talk to your colleague, whether you talk to the cab driver, whether you talk to, you know, the bartender, they don't feel nervous at all. It's nothing. Really, it's nothing.
Thomas also went and filmed outside the now infamous Huanan Haixian Shichang, the Huanan Seafood Market. It was boarded up and remained closed. But he went on to find out where these stallholders, the people who had been working the market, had moved on to. And this is him talking to a woman sitting behind a stall. Okay, Thomas, what are you saying to this lady and what is she saying back to you?
She is very defensive in the first conversation. She clearly isn't very friendly. As soon as I ask you from Huanan Seafood Market, is her first response was, what do you want? I asked her whether she was scared or nervous. When, you know, there was an outbreak in the seafood market, and her response was, you know, we were shut down during the entire pandemic and I didn't catch COVID, did I? That was her response.
Just a couple weeks ago, Thomas returned to Wuhan again a year after the outbreak and took a walk through one of the central shopping districts.
It's actually a district, it's comparable to the French concession in Shanghai where, you know, all the European powers had, you know, in the 19th and early 20th century, built a bunch of Western buildings along the riverside of the Yangtze River. So it's kind of a landmark for Wuhan. I'm quite surprised by the amount of people in there. They packed the whole streets.
Here's a bit of what that sounded like.
So I'm now in a major shopping district in Wuhan, and the atmosphere feels exactly like what it was in the first week of January, which is very relaxed, and they didn't even have a name for COVID-19 back then.
Now, we asked Thomas how he felt about returning to Wuhan a year later and what was the biggest change he has noticed. And we got an answer that went a lot further than we expected.
I think biggest thing that comes to my mind is obviously it's kind of personal in a way. I think the pandemic is personal to everyone, not just me. You know, my sister, I think in August, she went to the Netherlands to study her master's. And then I obviously had to come back to Shanghai, where the company needs me. And then my dad is in Guangzhou, because that's where his business is. My mom is all alone in Hong Kong. So as I was in Wuhan, and not just in Wuhan, actually, but I think in Wuhan kind of intensified the feeling of, you know, you are one family, but you are split across the world in four different cities. So, and you're not so sure when you can get back together as a family. It was kind of a difficult moment for me. And I'm sure that a lot of my colleagues in Hong Kong who are from mainland China had the same problem as well, because the last time they went home was probably, you know, Chinese New Year.
After his trip to Wuhan, Thomas is back in Shanghai now. This is what he's seeing in Shanghai.
Well, I mean, not everyone is wearing masks. So I think the general sense is people actually trust the government here. As you know, some people outside of China and overseas audience may not believe that the people actually trust the government here, despite all the other issues that we have reported on in terms of being transparent and all that. So they're pretty confident. Definitely, there's a very strong sense of nationalism in China these days, because people believe that China has triumphed in this pandemic as the winner.
One of the things we documented on this podcast on several of our episodes last year was the public sentiment in China in response to the pandemic and how it was energized by the story of Dr. Li Wenliang, the whistleblower who became world famous for his role in trying to warn his colleagues about the virus. He later died of COVID-19. We spoke to our colleagues following the discussions on Chinese social media and the pushback from the authorities. Here's a reminder of some of what was happening in February last year.
Right after the death of Dr. Li, almost all posts would get taken down, as long as they have a mention of Dr. Li or even just a slight trace of saying something regarding to his death. She saw people posting after the death of Dr. Li Wenliang, and she decided that she could write a program and help people to kind of beat the machine censorship. If you're typing in Morse code, people and machine sensors won't pick up what you're typing.
That was a colleague, Kin Chen, talking about people hacking social media to get their message out. So Mimi, I know that you've recently filed a series of stories about this Chinese citizen journalist who has faced a trial for her reporting in Wuhan, and it is a landmark case because it is a first since COVID-19. Can you tell us what happened?
Okay, Zhang Zhan, she used to be a lawyer, and when the city of Wuhan was under lockdown, everyone was trying to leave the city. Instead, she went into the epicenter trying to bring out independent reporting on what she sees on the ground, what he hears from the local people. So she posts about her findings on YouTube with her commentary. And in mid-May, after a few months of doing that, she was arrested by police in Shanghai and indicted for picking quarrels and provoking trouble. And last month, she was sentenced for 4 years. But Zhang Zhan is only one of the citizen journalists. She and other citizen journalists like her are trying to bring independent reporting from what they see on the ground in Wuhan and share it with the rest of the Chinese people. Instead, these people have been penalized. The price they are paying for having an independent voice inside China have been penalized.
So what is happening to Zhang Zhan now? What is the judgment handed down to her?
So a year after the coronavirus in China, people like Zhang Zhan, like citizen journalists like her, are paying to speak up, to push back and what they are doing is very little known by the majority of Chinese citizens.
But apart from Zhang Zhan, what about other liberal voices?
So a year after the outbreak, the coronavirus pandemic has actually further cemented the party's grip over society. From a number of human rights defenders, activists, intellectuals, liberal-leaning intellectuals that I've spoken to, they are commonly feeling a desperate sense of frustration and anxiety and not sure where is the next way out to go. Because what is happening right now seemingly has confirmed the way that the Chinese authoritarian model is actually a successful one in containing the virus, comparing to the chaos happening in the Western democratic countries. And that has a lot to do with the nationalistic pushback within China.
Mimi, it's really interesting what you were just saying, because we've heard that from Thomas Yao just now when he was reporting about the nationalistic sentiment that he was seeing in Shanghai and Wuhan. And this sentiment was actually further strengthened within China by the latest economic numbers.
So Finbar, you follow China economy and you did our first pandemic podcast. It's been a year after the outbreak. What is the economic impact to China?
We had some annual figures which came out on Monday, which covered the year 2020. So we know that last year China's economy grew by 2.3%. A couple of points on this. It's the lowest annual growth of the Chinese economy since 1976, which is the year Mao Zedong died. The Cultural Revolution was coming to a close. And by Chinese standards, this is very, very low growth. But by global standards, that's actually one of the highest you're going to get this year, or last year, rather. China is probably the only major economy to have grown in 2020. Vietnam, Taiwan are also going to grow, but they're not considered to be on the same scale as China. So after a sort of a disastrous first few months to last year, when everything was shut down, where the economy shrank by 6.8% year on year in the first 3 months of 2020, you know, by locking the virus down, by shutting it down, and by doing so in what was considered extreme terms at the time, China has been able to reopen more quickly and more consistently than other parts of the world, which are still trying to contain various waves of the virus 1 year on. We've seen that China was willing to, I guess, take that short-term medicine, which was very bitter, in order to reap the long-term benefit. And there are very lively debates about the manner in which China has managed its economic recovery. It's turned to the old playbook of build, borrow, and spend your way out of this. But I guess one side of the argument is that it has the results to show, 2.3% growth. The other is that maybe in the long term it's not a very sustainable model, but I think most countries would give their right arm to be in that position right now.
So Finbar, I know that last year you wrote a series of story about mass diplomacy and China's vibrant production on PPE, which was needed by many countries in the world. Where is that going right now?
The nature of the Chinese economy, top-down controlled state capitalist economy, meant that in the manner that it opened up, it was able to allocate the resources to parts of the economy where it was needed. So all through the spring months of last year, you had factories that were previously making electronics, making car parts, making cars themselves, making masks and exporting to the rest of the world. So what you've seen over the past year, Kinling, is that China's economic recovery has been largely based on this industry and export. So whereas the rest of the world has been locked down, China has been able to fire up the factories, make the medical supplies needed to contain viral outbreaks around the world, but also to make the goods that we need to work from home. So like, you know, when we're at home, we need our laptops, we need a chair, we need televisions. China's been making all of this stuff. So in a way, China's trade economy has been a net beneficiary of pandemic spread elsewhere in the world. So in a way, it's shown how a controlled and managed economy like China's can interact with a global capitalistic system, because they can essentially allocate the resources wherever they're needed. Again, whether that's long-term sustainable or not is a debate for another time, but it's certainly been a very interesting trend over the last year.
Where is China in economic terms comparing to where it was a year ago?
In some senses, it's back to where it was, Mimi. So in the final quarter of last year, the Chinese economy grew more quickly than it did in the final quarter of 2019, which means that the economy is gaining more than it was pre-pandemic. It's also taken up a much larger share of global exports. So China for years has been trying to turn away from this model of exporting its way to success. And it's gone back to that model because essentially it has the ability and the wherewithal to do so. There are arguments that China's managed recovery has not been sustainable. It's inherited a lot of debt. It's been relying a lot on state-led investment. And as you've seen, and I'm sure the stories we've been running, there's been a crackdown on private enterprise and so on, and some of these big tech companies. So there are lots of debates about that. But in terms of pure growth numbers, I mean, China's back where it was. The economy passed the 100 trillion yuan mark for the first time last year. You know, and these are things that Chinese officials seem very proud of.
This is all we have for you this week with Inside China. My name is Mimi Lau. Take a moment to like, share, and subscribe wherever you're listening from.
And I'm Kinling Lo. Wash your hands and keep your masks on. We just want to leave you with this song we found on YouTube. It's the Marsh family in the UK, singing a special tribute song about vaccine anxiety. Take care.
Well, the science is strong and they've yielded proof. You won't grow scales or camel's hooves. They duly checked with trials and then approved them. It's biological warfare. They broke all records but still took care. So please do not refuse to have the new jam. Have the new job, have the new job, have the new job, have the new job.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.